As always, even though that is the music from Two Guys Gaming, this is One Guy Reading. Hello and welcome. Whether you meant to or not, you found Noob's Book Club. I'm Sean, noob of all trades from Two Generations Gaming. And in this series, I am reading and reacting to the book, The Poppy War by R.F. Kuang. I don't know how long it's been since the release of the last episode, but I did 5 chapters this time, and then I have a plan to get the rest of the book finished by doing, you know, big chunks of chapters like that for the next few. And I don't think I'll be done by the time the new Dragonlance books comes in, but we're going to the Cape that week anyway, so I wouldn't be able to record. But I do have a plan to get this one done and then immediately start Dragonlance shortly thereafter, probably within the, because I have plenty of time down at the Cape to read and write up my notes. So in this episode, I'm going to go through chapter 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. That'll get me up to part 2, and then I can more or less just follow the chapters as they're laid out in the summary by Super Summary. That's where I get the summary for this book from, so that I don't have to write my own. I did pay for the summary, so if you want a similar summary, you're going to have to pay for it, but I will give it to you here. And if Super Summary, as with SparkNotes, wants to throw me some money or even just talk about a partnership of some sort, I am more than open to that possibility. Okay, without any further ado, let us get started with the summary. Part 1, Chapter 5, Summary. Rin is distressed by her expulsion from combat, which she believes is tantamount to expulsion from the school. Kate tries to comfort her, but Rin acutely feels the effects of the Academy's classism. That night, Rin wakes up, covered in blood, and rushes to the infirmary. A female assistant explains menstruation to Rin, who is horrified by the idea of having to undergo the process monthly. A female medicine apprentice says the infirmary will give her a concoction that permanently kills the womb. When Rin inquires with the physician, he is pleased but warns her it will be incredibly painful. Rin takes the concoction without hesitation. When Rin returns to class, she realizes that she must work harder than any other student. A month later, she scores at the top of her classes, second only to Kate. Her favorite class is strategy, where Master Urja only gives praise when earned and doesn't pander to Singardian elite. When Urja gives the class wartime hypotheticals, Rin demonstrates a willingness to enact brutal, even inhuman tactics. Urja pulls her aside to discuss her answers, and Rin admits that she confused tactics and strategies. A winning tactic could be a losing strategy if it sours the country against their rulers. Urja tells Rin she would be a good strategy apprentice. Determined to get around Jun's ban, Rin steals a book on ancient combat from the library and begins practicing the forms. She also studies fighting techniques at basement matches regularly, especially Altan's. Oh, I just noticed there's audio narration available for this study guide as well. This is a cool sight, I must say. Anyway, Part 1, Chapter 6. Winter settles on Syndergaard, and Zhang still never shows up for class, although students occasionally spot him around campus doing inexcusably rude things. That was a quote from the book. Rin alone continues to go to the garden to practice ancient combat. One day, Zhang enters the garden while she is practicing a balancing posture on a tree branch. He recognizes her combat book and asks her to demonstrate a form. He seems amused by Rin's thievery and by how much she annoys Jun. He offers to help her. When she tells a group of older students about her lessons, Rin is flooded with colorful stories about Zhang, most notably that he used to belong to the Psyche, a dishonorable militia division that carries out Daji's assassinations. Robin says that nobody pledges as Zhang's apprentice because lore is a bloody joke. That's a quote as well. Only Altan tried to pledge lore, but Raban says Zhang refused him. Rin meets Zhang the next day. He takes Rin to Widow Mong, who brings her a piglet. To build up muscle, Zhang says, Rin must carry the pig up and down a nearby mountain every day. For the next 4 months, Rin carries the growing pig up the mountain in the morning, attends class, then meets Zhang in the garden. While Jun's teaching is simplified and optimized for mass instruction, Zhang's is messy and unpredictable, but effective. He explains the lore and ideology behind various styles of martial arts before they were watered down into teachable military forms. After her last day carrying the pig, Jean takes a harder swing at Rin than ever before. The force of her ki shatters the stone beneath her. Jean is ecstatic and tells Rin to pledge lore rather than strategy. He tells Rin, quote, I can teach you more than ki manipulation. I can show you the pathway to the gods. I can make you a shaman, end quote. Thinking of her future career, Rin disappoints him by saying that she just wants to, quote, learn to be a good soldier, end quote. Part 1, Chapter 7. Zhang stops coming to lore class and avoids Rin. She regrets their estrangement, but is preoccupied by the impending trials, particularly Jun's two-day combat tournament. She knows Urja's apprentice bid depends on her performance in Jun's tournament. She continues to go to the lore garden to practice combat. One day, she comes across Altan practicing with a three-pronged trident. Altan knows that Rin practiced with Zhang. After tripping over her words, Rin excuses herself, embarrassed. The next section begins in the middle of Rin's trial. She aces Irja's exam. She gives her true opinion on Spear in Yim's exam. Jean asks a question he'd never mentioned in training. Who is imprisoned in Chulu Korik? Rin, at a loss, guesses unnatural criminals who have committed unnatural crimes. In Jun's tournament, Rin and Nisha tear through their opponents until they are set to face off in the finals. Robin tells Rin to surrender. Nisha is fighting dirty, and one of his previous opponents is permanently unable to walk. Rin refuses, wanting revenge for his treatment of her all year. Rin and Nisha's fight draws out. Nisha hits her repeatedly, causing Rin to burn with rage. She pins him when the referee calls for a break. Rin is reeling and feverish, burning with an irrational desire to disintegrate everything around her. She finds Zhang in the lore garden and begs for help. He utters a strange language over Rin and touches her with an icy hand. She faints. When she wakes, Rin feels normal. Zhang is at her bedside. Rin begs him to keep helping her. Zhang compares her to Altan. Quote, you are too reckless. You hold grudges. You cultivate your rage and let it explode, and you're careless about what you taught, end quote. He reveals that he didn't reject Altan. Daji hadn't let Zhang teach him. She'd wanted another spearly warrior and had given Altan to Irja so he could hone his, quote, rage like a weapon, instead of teaching him to control it, end quote. Since Daji doesn't know about Rin, Zhang agrees to take her on. Rin gets bids from strategy and lore, and she pledges lore. Part 1, Chapter 8. The students get 4 days off for the summer festival. Kitei invites Rin to stay at his estate. They ride to Kitei's house in the Jade District in a horse-drawn carriage, and Rin experiences an upper-class lifestyle for the first time. They watch a shadow puppet show retelling the Trifecta's actions in the Second Poppy War. 45 years ago, 3 children were orphaned by the Federation's raids. They walked to the peak of Mount Tianxin, where the gods reside. One pledged to the Dragon Lord and became the warrior with massive strength. Another pledged to the Snow Goddess and became the Vipress with bewitching powers. The last pledged the Great Tortoise and became the Gatekeeper, who could unlock and command the Menagerie of the Gods. The three gathered Nakan's 12 warlords. The Vipers poisoned them, and the warrior, later called the Dragon Emperor, compelled them to submit and pay homage to him, thus uniting the country. Kitei is disgusted by the Nakara politics in the story. He says that the Federation overtook Nakan because of the warlords' infighting. His father, Daji's advisor, thinks the same thing is happening again. Rin believes the Trifecta were shamans, but Kitei doesn't think that the theory is credible. Rin insists that strange powers exist. She is aware of the gaps in their understanding about the world. The festival culminates in a parade featuring giant puppets and a procession of noble families. Rin watches the phoenix puppet with great interest. She and Kitei notice that Nasia's father, the dragon warlord, is absent from the rest of the statuesque House of Yin. Rin sees Daji for the first time and is mesmerized. Quote, she would have torn apart kingdoms for this woman. This was her ruler. This was whom she was meant to serve, end quote. Part 1, Chapter 9. After the festival, Rin returns to school for her second year at the academy. Zhang reveals that during her fight, she accidentally called a god. He gradually reconfigures Rin's perception of what, quote-unquote, real is. Zhang can do things no ordinary human can, like call up a gale or make shadows, quote, twist and screech, end quote. He often sends her on cryptic missions to the library with guiding questions such as, quote, why do we have gods, end quote. He asks her to craft connections between disciplines rather than separate them like the rest of the school does. The next spring, Zhang takes Rin up a mountain for a lesson on, quote-unquote, plants, which turns out to be psychedelics. He says that while opium and heroin are highly destructive to the mind and body, Poppy seeds allow shamans to alter their consciousness and commune with the gods. Rin believes that they can spread the word about the truth of shamanism, but Zhang enters a melancholy mood. Quote, "Lore is a joke. I have searched for years for an apprentice, and only you have understood the truth of the world," end quote. Over the next weeks, Rin grows frustrated that Zhang won't give her psychedelics. He says that despite her aptitude for lore, she is careless. He had 4 previous lore students become irrational after accessing the god's pantheon. Toward the end of their second year, tension with the Federation escalates and Rin's cohort begins to fracture along, quote, provincial and political lines, end quote. Though the Federation's Emperor Riohai has not declared formal war, students depart their home provinces to fight. Zhang avoids all questions about Mugen, saying he doesn't remember his role in the Second Poppy War. At the end of the school year, Zhang sends Rin to a nearby mountain to meditate for, quote, as long as it takes, end quote. She meditates for weeks until, quote, her consciousness had expanded to encompass the totality of life on the planet, end quote. She sees a spearly woman who warns Rin not to take the power of the phoenix will offer her. Zhang is thrilled by her enlightenment. Rin doesn't tell him about the spearly woman or the phoenix. Thank you again to Super Summary for that excellent and succinct recap summary. And now for my initial thoughts as I read through. Pain is the price for success. Success required sacrifice. Sacrifice meant pain. Pain meant success. We know this about her. She burned herself with hot wax while studying for the test. But this expands that line of thinking. Moreover, it develops an infinite feedback loop. That means that the more she sacrifices, feels pain, and ultimately tastes success, the more that she will sacrifice in order to feel that pain in the hopes of more success. So let's unpack that. As you may guess, in my case, it falls apart quickly. Success requires sacrifice. That's true on some level. However, need it be? I know I lost a lot of you. Of course it's true. And yes, you don't get some measure of success without sacrifice. Hey, look, I never questioned the underlying precept. You know me better than that. Hell, in fact, I agreed with it. Yes, I added the caveat, quote-unquote, on some level. Ah, are you starting to get it? Put that together with everything else I said in this series and the others. It always adds up eventually. Let me tell you a story. For 5 or 6 years, I grew a vegetable garden in our backyard. The usual, tomatoes, peppers, beans, salad greens, corn once, tried onions and carrots, that sort of thing. I got lazy, and we spent less time home in the summer. So the garden went away for a few years. I thought about and discussed bringing it back. When Aiden agreed to work on it as well this year, we teamed up to make it happen. Peppers, peas, tomatoes, kale, lettuce, broccoli, and various squash. All growing and yielding vegetables. Success! And yes, it took some sacrifice. Working a few hours on the beds, tending to the weeds every couple of days, watering the plants when it doesn't rain regularly, picking mostly peppers and tomatoes right now, a few peas, 1 eggplant, you get the point. But my main point is the success far outweighed the sacrifice. And while I'm not yet discussing it, absolutely no pain other than a bit of sweat on warm days. For me, that begs the question, why then does our society require so much sacrifice for so little success? You work at least 8 hours a day, away from the ones you love, at a job you hate. That's a full third of your life, if you think about it. You sweat, bleed, and exhaust yourself beyond reason for people who yell, swear, and sometimes threaten you with violence. You get 2 weeks of vacation out of 52 a year, some sick and personal time, parenthetically, if you think to use it, and they let you, in parenthetical. And still you pick up extra shifts and volunteer for overtime. For what? Enough money to pay your bills? Feed your family, and maybe have enough left over for a movie, dinner, or some other small pleasure? The chance to compete with dozens of others for the opportunity of more work and more responsibility for just a bit more money? Another vacation week every 10 years? A plaque and some other pittance after 20 or 25? Ulcers, disturbed sleep, mental health issues, and back problems to keep that extra money? Or maybe take even more work and more responsibility for just a little bit more money? You've given how much of yourself, your body, your mind, your spirit, for what in return? No, thank you. Okay, Buster, you champion education, right? I assume that to set yourself up for a better job, right? That's often the selling point of college. Well, first, college should not have been a jobs program. Society co-opted and corrupted it to pump out more worker drones, dependent on it to feed the machine. I mean, MBAs? Really? What the fuck is that? They shit on liberal arts degrees and then try to convince me that it takes a brain to say a buy low, sell high? Get the fuck out of here with that bullshit. College is meant to expand your horizons, to teach you about the things that it would take years of experience to learn. In fact, most education should just simply be asking questions and hoping to maybe find the answer. But I will concede up to middle school and maybe even high school. You want to make school rote memorization to drill facts and figures up until then? Fine. But college? College should be different. And it's not. Today a kid asked, why is college so expensive? Good question, I replied. And not one that I have a good answer for. I mean, the kid's in sixth grade. Why crush them so early in life? Besides, my aide gave them a taste by telling them that she planned to spend all her money on groceries this weekend. All that being said, let's forget that and go with the original argument. College mimics the same bullshit pressure cooker environment. Lost sleep, ulcers, possible mental health issues, all to get those grades and that degree, for the chance at the opportunity to compete with hundreds of others, for that job that gives you back what? You may say that I'm being negative. That's fine. I'm just saying that the sacrifices that you make aren't rewarded in kind with success. Certainly not in any proportional way. It's just madness. I already talked some about the pain as a result of the sacrifice. Nothing about that makes any sense to me. That completely imbalances the equation. So let's move on. Related, she also says that all options lead to misery. But at least this is a good misery. Wow, I mean, that's certainly something. Best you can hope for after all that pain and sacrifice, that success they promised, the prize at the end of the rainbow is quote-unquote good misery. Holy fucking shit. Stop the ride. I went off. Like, seriously. What the fuck even is that? Good misery? An oxymoronic existence that takes whatever is left of that spark inside of you, your soul, and crushes it out of existence? I know what some of you are thinking. Sean, this book mirrors the history and society of China. You are comparing Ren's journey in that oppressive environment to our United States. This country, our country, is different. Yes, technically you're right. There are differences. I talked about some of them in the last episode. I also discussed my own advantages, my privileges, if you will. But just because something is better, that doesn't make it good. We may have more freedom, more mobility, but we very much have our own version of quote-unquote good misery too. The same or similar imbalances that I just laid out earlier. You do what's right for you and yours, but I'm not riding the treadmill anymore, and I advise my children to do the same. Another interesting side effect that this section talks about is Rin's reaction to praise. No surprise. No surprise, but she reacts positively. That's just people 101. Sure, we evolved some from the reinforcement-punishment dichotomy to focus more on the reinforcement side of things. Now, you can argue the efficacy of this choice, and I will have a discussion with you. Yeah, I told you last episode that I welcome discussion and even argument. It's one way to learn and grow. But since nobody listens to this, I won't hold my breath. Instead, let's focus on Rin. Not only does she react positively, but she finds herself needing the praise. She seeks it out. Again, not necessarily unique, but her own analysis of the situation intrigued me. She compared her need for praise to the heroin junkie's need for the high. One funny thing about this, parenthetically, and I've had this discussion more than once as well, in parenthetical, is that one addiction is considered negative and the other is positive, almost to the point of calling it a virtue. Now, I am not arguing that the need for praise equals the addiction to heroin. I'm simply saying that any imbalance could eventually lead to bad outcomes. Sure, the using heroin could cause an overdose, but what happens when that need for praise or love leads to sex with the wrong person and an STD or an attack or worse? I'm trading into dangerous territory here, and I don't want to inadvertently hurt anyone. I just want us all to be able to reach our full potential without having to succumb to the pressures of some bullshit system based on the fever dream of some long-dead random white dude. Especially when that system is so easily subverted and perverted. It's just not fair. But Sean, you say, life isn't fair. Who is telling you that? The same people working to ensure that it stays that way. Rig the system. Then ensure everyone that there's no other way. I know I sound paranoid. I don't care. I'm sick of pretending that any of this makes sense. It's all a shell game where none of the shells contain a marble. It seems like more are starting to realize that. Like much of society, I hope it isn't too late to make a real and lasting change. I also made note of the part where they talk about the abuse that the first years endure. I think Kate says something along the lines of, the second years dealt with it last year, and they pass it to us. By this time next year, we will pass it on to next year's freshman class. Pretty common, no? Also pretty fucking twisted, right? What do you mean, Sean? That's just the way things are. I've never accepted that as an excuse, reason, or explanation. Tradition is not a justification for cruelty. Custom needn't discriminate against race, religion, class, or any other made-up bullshit that we let divide us. To answer the question, yes, I believe that we can all get along. Where I've lived and worked, I've seen the cycle of poverty and violence and abuse up close. When I first started working in Orange and Athol, I agreed with the students. Both towns suck, especially for the young, but they don't have to. you can learn and grow and change things. I'm not taking credit for this, but one town realized that and the other didn't. You see, those, them, the others. I know this sounds weird after what I just said about not discriminating, but it's along the lines of why can't you just tolerate my intolerance? If we continue to allow the billionaire class to exploit our resources, divide us among ourselves, and just control the narrative in general, we will cease to exist. We can't continue this death cult. None of it is sustainable. That's not what I want to discuss right now, though. One of the ways that they keep control over the masses is through that cycle of poverty and violence. As long as you have some other to direct that disdain, then you won't turn it on them. So we need to make sure that we stick together. Don't let ourselves be so easily divided. We've made some strides, but as usual, progress is slow, and that progress can be too easily undone. It's just also exhausting to keep fighting these same stupid fights, but we need to keep fighting them. Don't let the cycle of poverty and abuse trap you. So, given little to no hope and then offered a way out through our own hard work and extreme sacrifice, Rin takes the lifeline. She then makes a mistake that nearly costs her that new life, all simply because the former life haunts her. Realizing that, she now needs to work at least twice as hard as her already extended pace, she sacrifices yet more. Thankfully, one person understands her plight and gives her some measure of assistance. Good God, what a stupid species we are. Seriously, all these barriers are artificial. Who knows what advancements we lost because of the bullshit that we put each other through. It's infuriating. It follows the same flaw in logic that leads people to say shit like Thanos was right. Okay, Edgelord, we get it. If half of all living things are eliminated, then you think you have a better chance of a date. Nope, sorry, stay on topic. Let's argue for a minute that the basic premise is correct. He based his decision on diminishing resources, right? Okay, one way you can solve that problem is by eliminating half of all living creatures. But hear me out. What if part of that half is your family, friends, other loved ones? Or if you're completely alone, what if maybe, just maybe, you were in that half? What then? I guess thanks for donating to the cause, GG, no re, and all that. Well then, Sean, what do you propose as a solution? I'm glad you asked. You know me so well. If you have infinite power, why not simply create twice as many resources? 3 times as many? 5, 10? Infinite resources? Why uphold the inherently unfair system that discriminates and causes harm unequally? Wait a minute, unless... Oh yes, of course. I get it now. Regardless of that, she finds her place in the Academy. In the process, she also begins to find her place in history. Sorry for the slightly poetic language there. I wanted to keep it spoiler-free. If you're wondering why I care so much about spoilers, relax. It's not for you. It's to keep you listening for a big reveal later. Hey, I'm not immune to the tricks. I just usually think they're dumb and unnecessary. Now that I found a use, I'm using it. Anyway, let's move on. One thing I will reveal is that Rin learns that she is a shaman. I only bring it up because I need to admit something. Quang makes the practice and study of shamanism sound so cool that I actually went searching for a way to follow that path myself. Those who know understand why I might be interested, and even why it's funny. If you don't, let me explain. I'm not religious, and no, I don't even consider myself quote-unquote spiritual. I think that both concepts give humans the liberty to pass off their bad deeds in a way that's unhealthy. So, I just chuckled at myself when I put shaman into the search bar. Keeping score. I need to take a minute to pat myself on the back. Many of my predictions from last time came true. Rin put aside her petty hatred of Nisha to concentrate more on her studies. What I didn't realize was that decision would pay off big time. She got her chance to exact revenge on him in the tournament. Granted, that also became the driving force of the story so far. So, big miss there for me. Another miss, parenthetically sort of, is that I thought she might try to get back in Jun's good graces. It's sort of a miss for a couple reasons. One, she tried but failed. He finds his prized pupil in Nisha. Two, she flourished without him. But all of this led to my biggest quote-unquote win, that I don't remember if I actually framed as a prediction last time. I simply said the folklore and these types of stories eventually become established lore. While not completely there yet, Rin showed potential as a fire shaman, and finally gained Zhang's trust enough to let her meditate on her potential and possible destiny. You can call it cherry-picking if you want, because after all, we've all seen these stories before, and it follows the hero's journey. Now that I think about it, even though the trope dominates Western pop culture now, it must have come from an Eastern philosophy or legend. Nothing of Western European culture is original. Maybe that's a low blow based on the quote-unquote seven possible stories saying or whatever, but we deserve it. Okay, before I stray too much into white guilt, let's move on. What I like least. Oh boy, this book is taking me places. I hoped for Rin. I wanted to escape her circumstances. This might sound like I'm setting up for a classic build them up to tear them down. However, I promise you that's not my style. I used to be jealous of success, especially writers, but I've grown. I've matured. I'd be lying, though, if I said that Rin's direction wasn't worrying me. She's got a taste of that power, and now she wants more. I suppose that makes sense given her history. Still, I hoped she might react differently. Again, I can't hope to know the desperation or hopelessness that she felt, and I don't want to compare my history with hers. Finally, I never felt power like she has now. With all of that being said, how long until she becomes that which she hates? I hold out hopes, but it feels inevitable. As of right now, I hate Rin's direction. I don't want her to fall from grace and have to redeem herself. She shouldn't have to have some epiphany to realize that she's gone about things the wrong way and must change her ways in order to achieve her destiny. I know it makes me sound like a hater. I don't mean to, but it won't end here either. Hey, you all want what I liked least. I'm giving it to you. Okay, that's actually bullshit. I set up the template and refused to change it. Then I blamed you. Crap. Seems like the tendency to turn evil might be contagious. Anyway, moving on. Why can't we get a hero that just does heroic things, without the complexity of humans and human emotion? Funny enough, I used to love that about Marvel and Image Comics, who explored the human and even the dark side of heroics. Now that I'm older, I want less complexities? One of my favorite books recently is Superman, a hero I traditionally despised. And my favorite hero of all time, Spidey, I hate what they've been doing with that book lately. I suppose it makes sense. There's already so much moral ambiguity in real life. I don't need my fiction reminding me of that. But fiction is based on conflict. And where's the conflict there? There's just no inner conflict. The old man versus man versus nature, instead of man versus himself. Some might argue that makes for less interesting stories. I disagree. The tortured hero bit just feels like the norm right now. If someone figured out a way to tell an interesting story from the perspective of a true hero or villain, I think it works. So other frustrated writers out there, here's your chance. Let's make millions. None of this, of course, makes me any less likely to read the rest of the book or the series, but you might have to suffer through me complaining every now and then. Hopefully Kwan gives me a chance to see the light at the end of the tunnel. At least then I can pepper the disappointment with hope and make the complaints less of a focus. What I like best. This one is easy. I already mentioned him in the last episode. But first, a word of encouragement to give the previous complaint less bite. I read the excerpt on the back of the book. It talks about a mentor that may be insane. And I give Kwan credit. While she seems to have telegraphed the main hero story, she kept me in suspense in this one. First, I thought the tutor Feyrich might accompany her to the university to continue as her mentor. Alas, he went back to the big fish in a small pond life he knew. Then, even after her banishment from his class, I thought she might wind up, somehow, back in Jun's good graces and study under him. However, his prejudice runs too deep, and looking back, I never had a chance. Now it is obvious. Then, though, I think you can forgive me for the thought, right? In the end, the actual answer ends up being obvious. Elusive and untouchable, enigmatic and offensive, willing to give her an opportunity even after she disappoints him. And, as an added bonus, he reminds us just enough of her tutor back home that she feels comfortable with him and trusts him. Her girl winds up with Zhang. When I mentioned him last episode, I said he reminded me of my old physics professor. More and more, that's true. Yadu always made us find our own answers. He also shunned tradition in favor of new things that might just end up in chaos. One of my favorite Yadu quotes, quote, "I just taught an entire physics class without mentioning physics once," end quote. I very much try to model my own teaching after him as much as I can. The restrictions of public school make it hard. So I feel a similar comfort with the madman, Zhang. Sadly, Yadu passed away before I was able to truly learn all that he had to teach. But it goes to show how much impact one person can have in such a short time. I don't know Zhang's fate, but I will enjoy him and his quirks for as long as I'm allowed. What next? I already talked about my fear that Rin's path takes her to a dark place. Maybe Kwong will zag, and we won't go there, but I doubt it. I mean, it just makes sense for the character. Comes from nothing, discriminated against even when she proves herself. Finds power, literal world-changing power. And now, faced with the choice of using that power to better herself and the world, or use it to exact revenge on those who wronged her. I mean, we can all see where this is going, right? Add in the fact that she's young and described as impulsive. So yeah, shit's about to get ugly. To her credit, the discrimination and abuse is real shit. So settling a few scores along the way is understandable. One score in particular may end up with some interesting developments. What happens between her and Nisha? Because I have some ideas. Let's discuss them. Does he become emperor with one of hers as generals? Maybe the reverse? I can't tell which I want to happen more. I think that Nisha as emperor might humble her. However, it could end very, very badly for Rin. Likewise, the other scenario may end poorly for both involved. Even the third possibility that they remain foes brings only destruction too. Am I just overly negative right now, or is there no good resolution for them? I can't see one. In addition, I worry that Jiang might become opposition during her heel turn. And now for my final thoughts. I could not put the book down during this read-through. The battle with Nisha, even though you knew it was inevitable, still lived up to the hype. I actually worried during the fight that he might win and even injure her. I'm glad that Rin gave Nisha a humbling, though. Then the whole port was Jiang. I chuckled constantly. I even laughed out loud more than once. His attitude and demeanor just took me back to those frustrating physics problems and the feelings I got when finally figuring out the answer. I never took opium or hallucinogens to solve them. However, I often joked that I did my best math and physics after a beer or two. In any case, I'm enjoying the book immensely, and I can't wait to finish it. Hopefully my plan works, and I'll be able to do so before Dragonlance arrives. As always, thanks for listening. You can find us if you haven't already at www.twoguysgaming.net. We have articles. I did an article on Marvel Strike Force. I just did an article on the new paints that I put on my Warhammer models. Today I'm going to talk about the Capcom versus Marvel collection that is coming out sometime in 2024. That's all I can find. Can't find the exact release date. There's nothing on our YouTube right now, but I'm working to get that started up again starting in August. I want to do some things with it. It might not even happen in August because of the cape and everything. And I mean, going back to school is going to make it tough too. So I'll try to get it rolling in August, and then hopefully that momentum will keep me going through school. I've got the Instagram running a little bit. I've been talking about we watched the movie If the other day, which was cute. I talked about the latest programming project that I'm working on. Which is just like a little Morse code thing. It's going to take a message that the people type in and turn it into Morse code and then send the Morse code to a light to blink. I don't know if I'll be able to give it like web capabilities, but I think that would be cool where people can come in, type their message, and then see their message in Morse code. That's where I'd like it to go eventually, but I don't know how long it's going to take there or even if I'll end up there. I also had an idea for an app, a companion app for the aquarium, because we went into Boston this past weekend. It's one of the reasons that it took me a while to get this out. And we went to the aquarium, and I thought it'd be cool to be able to like check off the fish that you see, or, you know, take pictures of the fish that you see, and it'll tell you what that fish is and check it off for you or whatever. That's like way down the line. I don't even know how to develop an app, but it's an idea that I had. And who knows? Somebody may have already done it. What else is going on around here? One more week of summer school next week, and then we're off to the Cape and Niagara, and then it's back to school. So yeah, I should get the YouTube going on in August as much as I can. I will be back with this series next week at least once, hopefully twice, because I need three more episodes based on the schedule that I put together. And I will talk to you then. Bye, guys. We are